Good evening, everyone. I want to ask now whether it's all right for you to come next week, next Tuesday, or is this a problem? Who will have a problem coming next Tuesday? Thinking it's the start of the Thanksgiving week. Okay, so they're not turning Thanksgiving week into a week-long holiday. Okay. Seemed 2 weeks ago they were turning Halloween into a holiday, since only, what, about three of our regular students were here on that day. And it was a very important class, because that was the part of the greater discourse on the elephant's footprint, which brings together, I think, the only place in the Sutta Pitaka which brings together these two schemes of the five aggregates and the six sense bases. And so those of you who didn't come can still get it when it gets put on the website. Okay, today, and I announced then that I would be taking for today's class the greater discourse to Malankyaputta. This is number 64. Number 64 in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Maha Malankya Sutta. This is on page 537. And this is a sutta given, it begins with a conversation with a monk named Malankyaputta. If you remember, this is the same monk who is the subject of the shorter discourse to Malankyaputta. This was that monk who one day was sitting in meditation and then speculating about these questions, whether the world is eternal, not infinite, and so on. And then he said, I'm going to go to the Buddha and ask him these questions. If the Buddha will give me an answer to these questions, then I'll stay with him. If he doesn't give me an answer to these questions, then I will leave the Sangha and go find another teacher. And then when he came to the Buddha and gave the Buddha that option, then the Buddha said, when you join the Sangha, did I ever tell you that I'm going to answer those questions for you? And then the Buddha used the famous simile of the man shot with a poisoned arrow who doesn't allow the surgeon to remove the arrow until he finds out the name of the man who shot him, what social class he belonged to, how tall he was, what color skin he had, what kind of material he used for the arrow, and so on. Okay, so the sutta takes place in the Anathapindika's park at Savatthi. And the Buddha opens the discourse, he addresses the monks and says, do you remember the five lower fetters as taught by me? These are called the Panch Oram Bhagyani Sangyojanani, the five lower fetters, because altogether there are 10 fetters which bind sentient beings to samsara, to the round of existence. And to gain full liberation, all of these 10 fetters have to be eradicated. But the 10 fetters fall into two groups. The first group are called the five lower fetters, because these are the five fetters that bind beings to the sensuous realm of existence. And then the five higher fetters are fetters which bind beings to the form and the formless realms. If you remember in the Buddhist cosmology, the Buddhist picture of the universe, there are these three domains or three realms of existence. Okay, so within the sensuous sphere of existence, the kama dhatu, we have 10 planes of existence, the hells, the animal realm, the sphere of hungry ghosts or tormented spirits, human beings, and then the deva realms or heavenly realms. And what keeps living beings, ourselves, tied or bound to these planes of existence are the five lower fetters. And then even if one breaks the five lower fetters, then one becomes a non-returner. This is called an anagami, which means that one doesn't come back anymore to the rebirth in the sensuous realm of existence. One doesn't come back to rebirth in any of these 10 planes of existence, of unhappy existence. But one is still bound by the five subtle or higher fetters to rebirth in the form realm, that's the realm of the Brahma deities. And there's about 15 planes in that realm. And then above that, there is the formless realm, of which there's four planes. The subtle or form, the higher fetters bind one to rebirth even within the formless realm. Okay, so in this sutta, the Buddha is asking simply, what are the five lower fetters? And the monk Malankyaputta says that he remembers the five lower fetters. And then the Buddha asks him, how do you remember them as taught by me? And then Malankyaputta says, I remember identity view, sakkaya ditti. This is the view of a self existing in relation to the five aggregates. I remember this as a lower fetter taught by the Blessed One. I remember doubt as a lower fetter taught by the Blessed One. I remember adherence or clinging to rules and observances. This is clinging to things like rites, rituals, ascetic rules, with the belief that just by following these practices, these observances, one can gain liberation. This was a common belief in India in that period, even today. So clinging to this kind of belief or view is a fetter taught by the Blessed One. And I remember sensual desire as a lower fetter taught by the Blessed One. I remember ill will or anger as a lower fetter taught by the Blessed One. Okay, that is how I remember the five lower fetters is taught by the Blessed One. Right? Okay, now the Buddha says, Malankyaputta to whom do you remember my having taught these five lower fetters in that way? And this is rather strange because this is the way the Buddha usually teaches the five lower fetters. If you look, especially in the Samyutta Nikaya, there are many suttas where the Buddha says, what are the five lower fetters? And he just enumerates them exactly in the same way. So why does he pick out and question Malankyaputta here? As though he's saying, by his question, he seems to be implying, I've never taught the five lower fetters in that way before. He seems to be saying, who did you ever hear me teach the five fetters in that way to? Right? Doesn't that seem to be the implication of that question? Why do they do that? Anybody have any idea?
Seems like he's not asking who did I teach what they are, but who did I, you know, impart the inherent attachments to? Who did I actually give these to? I didn't actually give those to this, like the example of the young infant that he gives. That's not been taught to them, they just have them. So it seems to me that he's not saying, who did I teach this to, but more, who? I didn't actually have to teach this to any being. The sentient beings already have these things. But that's the implication I can see. But I don't know. I'm just guessing.
No, the question is, to whom do you remember the five lower fetters as having been taught?
I think it's not asking directly who among the beings, who have I taught this to, more asking who had to be taught this. But that, like I said, I'm just guessing. I don't know.
I don't quite understand.
That it's not something that needs to be taught. Mm-hmm. That these are concepts that he's explaining, but they're not things that are taught to. The example of the young infant. The young infant has them already. It would need to be taught to the young infant.
Of course, the young infant has the five.
Right, they have them already. They don't need to be taught to them. That's what I'm saying. That he's saying, oh. I'm saying he's not asking, okay, well, who did I teach this to? He's saying, well, you know, I didn't actually have to teach this to the sentient beings. They had this already. I believe that's the implication I'm reading into this. But I could be misreading.
I'll think about that explanation. Anyway, I don't, taking the question the way I understand it, I don't know the answer to my question. It's not that I have some answer stored up in my mind, it's just it's a puzzle to me also. Anyway, here the Buddha goes on to say that if you were to answer in that way, then the wanderers of the other sects can refute you with the simile of the this is the young infant who's lying on its back, doesn't even have the notion of Sakaya. Sakaya means this person who is the combination of the five aggregates. So how could this infant have an identity view? Okay, and so the infant doesn't have an identity view. He's not formed an identity view, and yet this is what the text says. Anusati tveva asa sakaya dittanusayo. There is lying latent within him the underlying tendency to identity view. Okay, so the tendency to identity view lies within him. I think I see the way that the idea is starting to take shape. Okay, let's just continue. The young, tender infant lying on its back. Okay, here, this is interesting. Does not even have the notion, the text says, dhammesu, dhammas. Here it's translated teachings, but we could also translate it as things in general. So how could doubt about the teachings arise in him? Or how could doubt about things arise in him? So a newborn baby doesn't even have yet any kind of picture of the world, let alone ideas about religious teachings. And so, if you just look at the little baby, you say, there's no doubt, that little baby has no doubt about the Dhamma, no doubt about the Buddha, about the Dhamma, about the Sangha. He has no identity view. Okay, the young, but the anusaya, the underlying tendency, lies within him. Then the young, tender infant lying on its back does not even have the notion sila or silesu. That could be translated precepts, rules. So how could adherence to rules and observances arise in him? And yet this underlying tendency to adherence to rules and observances lies within him. The young, tender infant lying on its back does not even have the notion kamesu, sensual pleasures. A kama, he doesn't even have the notion kama. So how could sensual desire or desire for sensual pleasures arise in him? Yet the underlying tendency to sensual lust, here the text uses a different word, kamaraga anusaya, lies within him. So if anybody tells you, in a psychology class, Sigmund Freud was the one who came up with the idea of, what is it called, the sexuality of children or of infants. You tell that psychology professor, 2,500 years before Freud, the Buddha said it in Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 64. And your psychology professor will say, really? Show me the place. Okay, then the young tender infant lying on its back does not even have the notion of other people, other beings. So how could ill will towards beings or people arise in him? The little infant just gets, if it gets annoyed, it just gets annoyed with unpleasant sensations. And yet the anusaya, the underlying tendency to ill will, lies within him. Okay, so this would be the kind of reasoning that these wanderers of other sects would use to refute the idea that identifies the fetters with simply identity view, doubt, adherence to rules and observances, and so on. Because they point out that these underlying tendencies are existing in the infant. But this seems to be ascribing to the wanderers of other sects the idea that underlying tendencies exist in, say, newborn infants. Whereas that idea seems to me to be something quite original to the Buddha. Doesn't it? Especially the term anusaya. Anusaya, to my knowledge, was a term that was invented by the Buddha. Okay. Anyway, when the Buddha says this, now Venerable Ananda speaks up and he says to the Buddha, "Now is the time for the Blessed One to teach the five lower fetters." So now he's asking the Buddha to give a precise explanation what is meant by the five lower fetters. Okay, so now the Buddha says, "Here an untaught ordinary person," this is the worldly person, "who has no regard for the noble ones and is unskilled and untrained in their teaching," and so on. "This person lives with a mind that's obsessed and enslaved by identity view. The worldly person is always forming some view of self and trying to relate this idea of self to the five aggregates. And he does not understand, as it actually is, the escape from the arisen identity view." According to the commentary says that the escape is Nibbana, but I don't really feel so comfortable with this explanation in the commentary. I would say that the escape is rather the means of getting rid of the identity view. Okay, and then the Buddha says, "And when that identity view has become habitual," this is the translation here, which I'm not so satisfied with, but first I'll read this translation. "When that identity view has become habitual and is uneradicated in him, it is a lower fetter." Then the same is said with regard to the other four fetters, with regard to doubt, adherence to rules and observances, sensual lust and ill will. In each case, one dwells with a mind obsessed and enslaved by that particular defilement, and one does not understand, as it actually is, the escape from that arisen defilement. And when that defilement becomes habitual and is uneradicated, then it is a lower fetter. The words that are translated here, habitual and uneradicated in him, the Pali expression is tamagata apati vinita. Tamagata it would translate become strong, attain strength. And apatti vinita means not removed, not dispelled. Eradication implies cutting off at the root, but not removed and not dispelled doesn't seem to imply, the word apatti vinita doesn't seem to imply such a radical eradication. But it can be just in our day-to-day life that we don't control these defilements, don't make an effort to suppress them, keep them out of the mind. So this is the sense of being a fetter. When these five states, according to this text, when these five states become strong and they're not subdued, not removed, but I have to say, this explanation strikes me as not so... I mean, I don't like to be contradicting the Buddha, but the explanation seems to me not so satisfactory, because first they're explained in relation to an uninstructed worldling whose mind is what's the expression used? Obsessed and enslaved by these five things. But let us take an instructed disciple who's not yet a noble one. But who's still practicing the path, still cultivating, and he's not yet reached any level of realization. We would still say that this person has the five lower fetters. He's not yet reached the stage of stream entry. He's making an effort to even to weaken these five defilements. Maybe he's reached a high level in practice of insight meditation so that the five are quite weak and that they're not actively obsessing the mind, so that they're not, we could say that they've been subdued, they're constantly being removed. But as long until they are actually cut off at the root, they will keep that person tied or bound to the possibility of rebirth in the sensuous realm of existence. And in that sense, one would have to say that they are still fetters. Yeah.
It says it becomes habitual. Once it becomes habitual, then it becomes a fetter.
That's what the text says. When it's
once something becomes habitual,
yeah.
Let's take smoking. Smoking becomes habitual because you don't think about it at all, and you do it all the time, and then it becomes habitual. And then you learn, okay, smoking is harmful. Well, that doesn't eradicate the habit.
Yeah.
You're still fettered by the habit.
Okay.
Because the habit was built up when you were uninstructed. Now that you're instructed, you could work on eradicating it.
Yeah.
But you're still fettered in the same way.
Yeah.
It's talking about the beginning of creation of the fetter.
Yeah.
But it doesn't talk about like what happens later on during the practice. That it no longer, it would be called a fetter at that point. It would still be a fetter. It had its beginning way back when you were an uninstructed worldling.
When you were what?
When you were an uninstructed worldling.
Okay, it had a beginning when one was in an uninstructed worldling. But it seems the Buddha is giving special emphasis to this idea that these five states, it's not enough just to enumerate the five states. That's not enough to call them fetters, but it's when they become habitual and are not dispelled, not removed, that's when they're fetters. And so, when one is working to remove them, and they're not so habitual, as long as they can keep one bound to rebirth in the lower realms, I would call them fetters. Maybe let's take the next paragraph and see if that gives a contrast. Okay, a well-taught, noble disciple who is regarded for noble ones, who's skilled and disciplined in their teaching and so on, does not abide with a mind and obsessed and enslaved by identity view. He understands as it actually is the escape from the arisen identity view. An identity view together with the underlying tendency to it is abandoned in him. Let's see what that note says. Okay, I know what this is. Okay, and then the same thing is repeated for doubt, adherence to rules and observances, sensual lust and ill will. In each case, he understands the escape from it, and then that in each case his mind is not obsessed and enslaved by it. He understands the escape from it when it arises, and then that defilement together with the underlying tendency is abandoned in him. So actually there are several stages here. So it's not describing the disciple all at one stage, but we could see a sequence. First, in an earlier stage of training, he's abiding with a mind simply that's not obsessed and enslaved by these defilements. And now he knows the way, the practice, the path to remove it, to abandon it completely. We could say that that is the stage of the one on the path to removing the lower fetter. And then one who has reached the stage of non-returner, that is the one who has abandoned the five lower fetters together with the underlying tendency to it, to them. And here this passage is making an apparent distinction between an underlying tendency and the fetter, and what it is recommending, sort of the goal, is to get rid of not simply the fetter, but the fetter together with the underlying tendency. And this is quite consistent with the simile of the young child lying on its back. Because if we take the young child lying on its back, one would say that the young child lying on its back doesn't have the five fetters. This is using this definition of the fetter as something which is strong and not subdued, not removed, or habitual and uneradicated. Because for this young child lying on his back, we don't even have the notions on which these five defilements arise. He doesn't have any identity view, no doubts, no clinging to precepts and observances. Well, I'm not so sure about no sense. He doesn't have any kind of sexual desire. He does get anger, but he doesn't have ill will towards people because he doesn't even have the idea of a person yet. So one would say that this young child doesn't have, an infant doesn't have the five fetters. On that definition of fetter. But the infant has the five anusayas, the five underlying tendencies. Did you Would you have your hand, Sophie? Yeah.
Now, I think somehow I can go back to the beginning when you questioned why did Buddha say it, in what way do you remember the five laws that is important by me? If you emphasize in what way, then the Valukya enters really superficially, not talking about the way Buddha taught, like including anusaya and fetters. He just simply lined up all five of them, and
yeah.
The Buddha was, because the Buddha said, in what way do you remember? Meaning he was expecting, the Buddha was expecting Valukya to answer more, including anusaya and the fetters. And
yeah.
Then the answer was, if you answer that way, other sectors we can repute with the example of just the infant. So therefore, when you talk about five fetters, then you have to not just illustrate the five of them,
yeah.
You have to really explain.
Okay, maybe that's a good point. Okay, let me just put this in for the recorder. But if I understand your point, that when you're asked about the five lower fetters, it's not enough just to enumerate what they are, but one has to give some explanation about how they function, how they relate to the person's psychological life. If one just enumerates them as five states that can arise or not arise, then the outside wanderers will use that example of the infant to refute one. That's a possibility. Okay, let us go. Shall we go on? Anybody have any other idea? Oh, I had an idea. Something. Yeah, I was going to explain that the commentary makes things a little confusing by going back to what I call the more orthodox or typical way of explaining, which is to say that the fetter and the anusaya are really not different things, but are actually the same thing, but just looked at from two different points of view, or considered in terms of two different aspects. So it says that, taking, for example, Sakkaya Ditti, identity view, identity view can be considered a fetter in the sense of binding. That is, the special meaning of fetter is that which binds one to the round of birth and death. And identity view is considered an anusaya, an underlying tendency in the sense of being unabandoned or uneradicated. Because the underlying tendencies are these states that are unabandoned within the deep stratum of the consciousness, deep stratum of the mind. Yeah.
Could we say that they are underlying tendencies in the sense that they have become habitual?
One might say that for different people, different underlying tendencies, different people have the underlying tendencies in different strengths depending on their habitual actions, their habitual behavior patterns. And so when we behave in particular ways, when we act, speak, think in particular ways, our behavior strengthens the underlying tendency, reinforces the underlying tendency. And so even though the behavior changes from moment to moment, day to day, but because once that underlying tendency gets strengthened and reinforced, then that underlying tendency remains as a disposition in the mind to behave in that particular way. And then when there is the right stimulus, right provocation, coming together of particular external conditions, then it will provoke that underlying tendency, habitual tendency, to manifest in that same type of behavior. So everybody has these underlying tendencies until they get eradicated by the attainment of the different paths, supermundane, world-transcending paths. But people have them in different strengths depending on their own past behavior patterns, their own dispositions of character.
I'm just going to say, the simile of the infant, couldn't that be by virtue of his birth into the human realm? He automatically has the tendency, until he finds the path, that he will develop the fetters?
Actually, all infants who are born into the human realm have these underlying tendencies. Yeah, in fact, that's what the text says, that all in this young child lying on its back, these underlying tendencies are present. Yeah, the point is just that even the idea on which the fetter is based is not yet present. So one can't say, on this understanding of the fetter, one can't say that the fetter is present. But even though the fetter is not present and can't be present, the underlying tendency is there. But here, it seems that at the bottom, one is returning to the position, in that last sentence, one is coming back to the position that the underlying tendency is really the fetter itself, since that is what keeps one in bondage. And so what one has to eradicate is the underlying tendency. Okay, let us go. Oh, okay, Tom.
When the Buddha was born as a human, so he must have not reached that point of being unbound in his previous life.
Okay, the question is, when the Buddha was born as a human, he must have reached that point of not reach the point of losing the underlying tendencies. That is the case, the way it's understood, that of course he would have had the accumulation of many, many meritorious factors, perfection of many of the sublime virtues of countless past lives, but he hadn't yet eradicated these underlying tendencies, because that comes only with the attainment of full enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. Okay, now the Buddha says there is a path, a way to the abandoning of the five lower fetters, that anyone without relying on that path, on that way, shall know or see or abandon the five lower fetters. This is not possible. Then he gives a simile, just as when there is a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, it is not possible that anyone can cut out its heartwood without cutting through its bark and sapwood. So too there is a path, it just repeats the first sentence, there is a path and so on. And then the next paragraph states it positively. There is a path, a way to abandoning the five lower fetters, that someone, by relying on that path, on that way, shall know and see and abandon the five lower fetters. This is possible. Just as when there is a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, it is possible for someone that someone shall cut out its heartwood by cutting through its bark and sapwood. So too, by relying on this path, one can abandon the five lower fetters. So if one wants to get to the heartwood of a tree, one has to cut through the bark. The heartwood is the wood on the core of the tree. One has to cut through the bark and then through the wood on the outer rings of the tree. And so to cut off the five lower fetters, one has to rely on this path. And now, usually in the suttas, when we see the different stages of realization presented, we have four stages of realization. And the first stage of realization is the stage of stream entry. And that stage cuts off the three lowest fetters, the first three of the five fetters. It cuts off identity view, doubt. Actually, this starts to get a little complicated. I think we'd better leave this for next week. It gets too complicated to try to fit in a hurry now. Are there any questions on anything that we covered this evening? Anything about the fetters, anusayas? One thing I should mention about the anusayas is that another interesting point, usually in the suttas, we have two ways of explaining the anusayas. I think I've gone through these in class, and I think we've encountered them already. One is in terms of three anusayas, three underlying tendencies. One is raga anusaya, the underlying tendency to lust or attachment, which is based on pleasant feeling. The other is called patika anusaya, the underlying tendency to aversion based on painful feeling. And the other is called avijja anusaya, the underlying tendency to ignorance, which is based on feeling that's neither painful nor pleasant. Or neutral feeling. We already came across that set of anusayas when we did the sutta on the six sets of six, sutta number 148. And then the other set of anusayas is seven anusayas, seven underlying tendencies. This is the set of underlying tendencies that comes to dominate in Buddhist tradition, particularly in the Abhidharma systems. We find these mentioned in the Majjhima Nikaya in Sutta number 18. The underlying tendency to lust, to aversion, then to views, to doubt, to conceit, to craving for existence, and to ignorance. Is that seven? Doubt, conceit, craving for existence, and ignorance. Did I mention all seven? But this sutta here seems to be the only one in which underlying tendencies to things like adherence to rules and observances are mentioned. The underlying tendency to ill will is mentioned. Of course, we can relate the underlying tendencies from the set of seven to this, to these five underlying tendencies. But we don't come across these technical terms like the underlying tendency to adherence to rules and observances. I don't think we come across that any place else but the sutta. Okay, so after this sutta, if I finish it early next week, then we will do sutta number 52, which is somewhat similar. Sutta number 52 is similar to the second part of the sutta. So we could almost take them together. Again, I should mention that the week after Thanksgiving, that is November 28th, then I won't be here, so we won't have a class that week. Not because of an extended Thanksgiving vacation, but I have to go away that week. Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. Okay, we share the merits with the devas that protect the Buddhasasana, with the Buddhas, the dragon spirits, and with all other beings, wishing that they rejoice in these merits and protect the Buddha's teaching, protect the world, protect ourselves and others. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu sasanang akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva Chirang rakantu desanang akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparang atacha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhiya etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhiya etavata cha amhehi